jazz.
Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 123. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
Yeah, we're doing our best here, people. I am recording in northern Wisconsin, where the fish are plentiful and the internet is not. And we'll see if this works or not. So I was trying to think of connections of the four pieces we're doing today. A couple of them involve quartets. A couple are led by trumpet players. Three of them are live. Really, they don't have a lot in common.
Shakira's on a couple of them.
That's right. Yeah, that's another connection. And in very different modes, however. It's amazing the difference 3 years can make.
Yes.
So I guess I kind of thought that maybe we'd start with the short ones and then move into the two massive double live albums that you picked out. The ones I kind of picked as make weights for this show were just two ones that were kind of in my queue. So anyway, I picked a couple albums that have been in my queue I wanted to discuss. One, Stan Getz's Sweet Rain from 1967 is a little odd in that we have done a couple different Getz releases. But I wanted to bring it up because I don't think it's as well known as it should be, and it's just kind of been on my mind. The other one, Count Basie's Volume 2 of the Savory Collection, is a bunch of live air shots that a man named Savory recorded back in the 30s, and along with many, many, many other air shots, kept in a private collection for many decades. And recently, the collection was unearthed, and the process of restoring it began, and they finally cleared all the legal hurdles to be able to release a couple volumes of what has been discovered. So the first volume's kind of centerpiece was a 4 or 5 minute version of Coleman Hawkins playing Body and Soul with a bunch of other pieces. And then this one focuses on live Count Basie recordings featuring Lester Young. And so I thought we should talk about one of those, mainly just because this is kind of a story in the jazz reissue business, this discovery of the Savory Archive and the work to get it out in the public. So what were your two selections?
So my selections were Ambrose Akinmusire's A Rift in Decorum Live at the Village Vanguard, a double CD set from this year, released on the Blue Note label, and then a former bootleg, that's how most people knew it for a very long time, that Columbia, in their effort to milk every last tit on the Miles Davis cow, finally released back in, I guess, 2001, I think. And this is Miles Davis live at the Fillmore East on March 7th, 1970. So it'd been bopping around in bootleg versions for 30 years. And then Columbia finally decided, okay, let's get this one out there too. So those were that's also a double CD set. So those were my selections. Both of those live dates, obviously.
Cool. Well, I suggest we do them chronologically. Basie, Getz, and then Miles, and then Ambrose. Does that sound okay?
Sure.
So we have talked about Basie back on episode 65. We did the At Newport album from 1957, and that was the New Testament band. Lester Young guests on some of those pieces, but obviously he's kind of at the end of his string at that point. He puts in a strong performance for 1957 Lester, but the argument has been made that the prime Lester is pre-war Lester. And these recordings are taken from 1938 through 1940. So this is when he was originally in the band with Count Basie. And these are recently, again, recovered live air shots recorded by this man named Bill Savory. So I know we're bringing Basie back here, but it seemed worth talking about these in part just because it's kind of news in the jazz world. What do you think of this particular set of music?
Well, the first thing that I noticed as I listened to these was how similar many of the cuts are to the Newport date 20 years later. That is to say, is to repeat a point that's often made about Basie Basie's band in general and his rhythm section in particular, which was that those guys were locked in, and the live Basie you hear at Newport in terms of just how well that rhythm section plays together. They'd been doing it by the time of the Newport date for 20 years or more. And so when you first hear a lot of these cuts, they sound not that dissimilar to the stuff that we talked about in that earlier podcast. It sent for you yesterday that I was just like, God damn, it sounds the same, except the sound quality isn't as good.
Don't the moon look lonesome shining through the trees? Don't your eyes look lonesome when your baby packs up to leave? Sent for you yesterday, baby, here you come today. Sent for you yesterday, baby, here you come today.
So what's interesting here? Well, what's interesting here to me is, holy shit, Lester can blow. We know that he's a great player, but he's often associated with Billie Holiday and those smoldering ballads that he could deliver with that feather-like touch. And it's just really good to hear him in full throat on a live date with the Basie band just blowing people off the stand. He could play. It's a stupid thing to say, of course he could play, but I mean, we don't think of him as, or we typically don't think of him as a blower, as a get up on the bandstand and, you know, the kind of guy who would get into cutting contests or something. But I'd put this Lester up against a lot of fastest gun in the West tenors. My God, he sounds fantastic here, even through the and I'm not a big fan of this remastering. I don't think it's, I mean, it's obviously probably as good as they could get, but it's still a far cry from pristine. It's better than some of the remastered things that we've talked about here before. Having said that, I think you get a really good appreciation for just how powerful a player Young could be on a band stand with a band that could really blow. And we have this image of him as this sort of sensitive, effete, almost feline, feminine player. And he's a man among boys up on this bandstand. I think he's quite good. I don't know if you felt the same way, but to me, this was a little bit of a revelation in terms of just getting a different image in my head of Lester Young as a blower. I take it that most of the tenor soloing here is done by him, although I forget who else is on the bandstand with him, but he's not the only tenor player here. But he is featured, it seems, at least if the liner notes or the promotional material with this is anything to go by. Was that your feeling, or is that just me wishful thinking on my part that Lester is a blower on this collection?
No, absolutely, I'd agree. He's I think it's Herschel Evans, but don't quote me on that. They had a more Coleman Hawkins-esque tenor in the other chair, and they would play them against one another for contrast, and they're both quite good. Harry Edison's quite good on trumpet.
I'm going to look it up while you're talking. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah, the 38 through 40 Lester with the band is considered by many people prime Lester. And he's more energetic. He's booting the band along. He's doing some moves that eventually got integrated into rhythm and blues players. You kind of forget that aspect of his influence. We tend to associate him with a cool school, primarily white players. But he also has a kind of rhythm and blues legacy. And you can hear some of that here. And he is fleet. And he is energized and buoyant. That said, I think I agree with you to the sense that there is a certain sameness, and even here, and typically the Old Testament band or the first Basie band is the one considered by some jazz aficionados as the best, the most natural, the loosest, whereas the band in the 50s is quite machine-tooled, and it's beautifully controlled, but it doesn't necessarily have some of the invention and excitement of discovery that we associate with the best jazz. It's kind of become maybe a little bit mannered. And even here, I guess I detect some of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went back and listened to, I remember as a kid, I really got into getting these Blue Moon, which was a Spanish label, and there's probably been 100 Spanish jazz reissue labels because the copyright laws are kind of apparently lax in Spain. And Blue Moon did a series of Lester Young small group sessions on 5 discs, and they kind of crept into the Verve era when he was starting, his star was starting to dim, but they went all the way back to his first appearances on records with small groups. And, you know, my feeling is that is the very best Lester, in that you get the brilliant rhythm section often from Basie's band.
Mm-hmm.
You get a couple other soloists, but Lester's more in charge often. Musically, you get more length, you know, lengthier solos from him. And if you listen to a track like I Never Knew, you know, the big band version of it is a little mechanical sounding. His soloing is brilliant on it. But then when you listen to the small group version, he just transforms the song. It's like he heard it, he thought about it playing with Basie, and then when he was on his own, he just adds layers and layers of depth to it. Now, those layers eventually lead to kind of the melancholy, introspective Lester that some people felt was not as exciting and invigorating and masculine as the Lester with the Basie band. But for me, it's kind of the perfect moment when he's in the small groups, especially the early stuff. I probably like it a little bit better than this. And I would agree. So did you think, did it ever occur to you this was just too noisy to release? The sound was too rough?
You know what, my feeling was, my guess was, the success of the Coleman Hawkins Savory Collection, because that got a lot of accolades and a lot of attention. I think this was a not unworthy attempt to capitalize on that. And of course, the name to conjure with here is going to be Lester Young. But yeah, I'm not fond of the sound here. It's really, I mean, and obviously they've had to work hard to improve it, but it's tough. It's not as bad as, so for me, like maybe the nadir of live recordings would be some of the cuts on that Duke Ellington Live at Fargo, North Dakota, which sounds like it was recorded on a tape recorder in the back of someone's car trunk. You can hear the brilliance of the band, but it sounds like they're playing through a bass drum or something, and it fades in and out. It doesn't record all of the numbers in their entirety. It drives me crazy. Like, I love listening to it, and just when I get into a number, I get furious because there's a fade out or something. And it's like you can hear them. They're literally on the other side of a gymnasium. This isn't as bad as that, but it's not very good. I don't know. I mean, they probably did wonders. I can't imagine what it must have sounded like before they cleaned it up. But, you know, there's a lot of fuzz. There's a lot of scratch here. And it's a very, I don't know, some people might find that authentic sounding. I don't know, like it's your very own 45. But yeah, the sound's pretty rough. It's good enough, though, that you can tell that Lester is in fine cry. So it's got that advantage. But yeah, I'm with you. This is not the place I would go to hear Lester at his very best. But as a document of Lester playing with the Basie band at one of its high points, it's invaluable. And again, I just think it's good to get this to polish this image of Lester a little bit, that he's not just the balladeer. He's not just the sensitive soul. You know, he could get up there and blow with other guys and be the featured player in a band that had some real good blowers in it. So it's a nice corrective, and it's just invaluable from the period that it comes from. The Basie band had a long heyday in terms of the accomplishment of its rhythm section, but there are good players here. Besides Hirsch Levins, I think Chu Berry is in the band at this point, who never got the recognition he deserved, but he's there in that tenor section. And there's a handful of other names to conjure with who are in the band at this time. It's a valuable document, even if it's not the best sound. I'm glad they did it. I'm not, you know, I wouldn't not have this. But it's not the starting point for Lester. It's more a corrective, perhaps, to people who see Lester in only one way.
Sure. And I think it highlights in your discussion of the Fargo date, what happened with the Fargo date, I believe, is that it first came out as the best sounding, most complete performances from that recording. And then eventually people said, well, release it all. And so then you've got the stops and the starts and the partial performances and the really rough sounding ones. And so as a document, it becomes more and more complete, but as a listening experience, it becomes harder and harder to take. And it's always a judgment call with these kind of sources.
Exactly.
I'm assuming that, I don't know, that Savory made other recordings of the band, or may have, and they decided they're going to cherry pick them. You know, I thought of this guy, I'm sure he's a brilliant remaster, and it's kind of like, Jesus, can you raise Lazarus from the dead? And he's like, sure, and Lazarus comes back, everything's fine. Well, how about Fred over here? He was mauled by a tiger. It's like, well, give it a shot. But, you know, when Fred comes back, he doesn't look so great, you know?
Do.
Yeah, you know, he's like, missing an arm, kind of staggering around there. One of the weird choices they made, and to me, and maybe I'm just too superficial, the first 5 or 10 minutes of recording are pretty crucial. They kind of give me an emotional kind of back of the brain feel about the recording as a whole that is kind of hard to shake off. And the example I've given often is in Porgy and Bess, the Miles Davis album, there's some pretty heavy distortion very early on. And that makes me a little bit more negative towards that record, even though there's many brilliant portions of it, because I kind of associate dropping the needle on that or pressing play on that with a little bit of discomfort. And here, they put the two worst-sounding tracks right at the beginning. They're the most distorted and scratchy. I'm trying to puzzle out what the thinking there was. You know, why put the ones that came out worst first? Whether they figure once you get over this, everything is a downhill slide and you'll be thrilled. I just don't, you know, get you know, deal with them first when you still got the most energy, and then, you know. But many of the recordings in the middle here are pretty decent sounding. You can hear, I don't know whether it's swath or what. I mean, we have to remind ourselves this is pre-tape recording. You know, this is all taking place. Really the prehistory of recorded sound is some, that's not true, but in a rough period, and the pre-33 era, the pre-tape era. And so the methods he's using, and these were air checks too, are pretty rough. And then, you know, they were left, I think, in boxes for 50 years or something. So they had a hard life. It's amazing what he did, but like Jesus with tiger victim, you know, he can only bring back so much. And I don't know whether if, you know, when you're making that judgment call, whether a 45-minute cherry-picking of these tracks would ultimately do everybody a better service. I understand the historical want for completeness, and ultimately this is largely a historical document. Very few people are going to pop this one on for pleasure. But I worry about someone who wants to get to know about Basie, hears about this, and then kind of has a nervous breakdown by track 3 because it's just so rough-sounding. And, yeah, if you listen to the Deccas, the early cuts the band made before they got in Columbia, or you listen to Lester's small group stuff, I mean, it's not all perfect. It's not certainly in modern sound, but it's very listenable. It's largely, it's nothing like this. So don't, if you haven't listened to this material, don't start with this and then think, you know, I've got to be some kind of martyr to even attempt to listen to it.
This is not where you start with Basie. This is for someone who's, you know, or Young. This is for someone who's got their toes, you know, got their feet wet with Basie and with Young. And then you want to have a fuller picture, then you get this. And for Basie fans, for Basie completists, it's essential. But if you're just starting, you're exactly right. This is not the disc you would start with. Not because the music isn't good, not because they're not playing well, but because the sound quality is going to put you off, perhaps. So once you're familiar with the music, maybe you can look past some of that and you don't even notice it. You're just sort of listening to these soloists do what they do and listening to, I mean, this band is just so locked in on 1 o'clock jump. They could do that in their sleep, probably. Some of them may have been asleep when they were playing, or were drunk off their faces when they were playing it. And you'd never know because they were that tight. They were that good.
Okay, well, we have done Stan Getz a couple times.
Given the tape delay, I think I'm going to take to saying over at the end of a sentence so that you know that I've stopped.
Okay.
Over.
Over. Roger and out. So we've talked about Stan Getz before. We did the Getz Gilberto album from 1964 back on episode 58. And we also did People Time, a duet album, back on episode 70. And I think that was I'm not sure why we did that. Anyway, I did want to bring up
Kenny
Gentle Rain. I'm sorry?
Oh, sorry. That was Kenny Barron or Kenny Drew? It was Kenny, wasn't it?
It was Kenny Barron.
Absolutely. Yes.
So anyway, I just have kind of been wanting to talk about this record, Gentle Rain, from 1967, a Verve release, for a while. I ran across it on LP and then realized after a few listens it was becoming my favorite Stan Getz album. And this is a quartet recording he does with Chick Corea on the piano seat. And if you get could you look up the rest of the personnel, because I don't want to strain this internet any more than I already am. Over.
I have it right here. Okay. I have it right here. It's Ron Carter on bass and Grady Tate on drums.
One comparison contrast I did with this was the Captain Marvel release from a few years later on Columbia. And Chick Corea is there as well. And I think Tony Williams is on drums at that point, and probably Stanley Clarke on bass. And that's a pretty well-known, quote-unquote, modern Getz release. And I don't care for that one that much. It is very much Getz trying to find his way into Return to Forever material. And he just seems a little bit, I don't want to say lost, but off point. And the band seems a little bit insistent. And whenever Tony plays a drum fill, it sounds like a drum fill. It doesn't sound like part of the piece. And this, in contrast, I'm really fond of. So I don't know what you thought of Gentle Rain.
Well, my view was, as I dug into this, that this is Pat's wet dream. We are deep, deep in Pat's blanket fort when we listen to Stan Getz's Sweet Rain, which is not a bad place to be. Pat's blanket fort is warm and comfortable and inviting. And the thorniest personality here is that of Stan Getz himself. Everything else is groovy, cool, copacetic, and sweet, which isn't to suggest that this is not a complicated or difficult at times recording, but it's high on the pleasures and rewards of it are very high indeed. So when I listened to it, I was like, of course Pat loves this. Strongly suggest that if anyone goes out and gets this, they get the big boy headphones, because otherwise you're not going to hear Ron Carter. Ron Carter on bass is doing some pretty good stuff here, but he is down in the mix on anything without good headphones. You really need to be able to hear what he's doing. I thought this was wonderful. It was very pleasant, very pleasurable. And I went to the Penguins to see what they had to say about it. And they were a little pissy about Chick Corea on piano here, saying he was perhaps a little too prissy or something. And I don't think that's quite right. Getz was a difficult personality, and Korea is, I've increasingly come to think, and I'll say this on the next thing we talk about, he is a great listener reactor. He pairs well. He's particularly good, it seems to me, when he's clued in or keyed in to one player in an ensemble, or he's playing duets. He's just really good at that. He's a great listener. He's a great reactor. To use a metaphor, the Floyd Mayweather of jazz players. He's a great counterpuncher, which isn't to suggest that he can't sort of take the lead. He can. It's just that he's a very, very good player who's sort of receptive to and can embellish or react to lines that other people are laying down. In a setting like this, you know, Stan Getz, this is definitely Stan Getz and others, right? The rhythm section here exists for his comfort and support. They are not getting much in the way of solo space. Certainly nothing for Grady Tate. He doesn't even get a lick. Ron Carter may have a bar somewhere in here, but it's hard to hear. Corea, his job here is to embellish and provide better than average accompaniment for Getz and to take a chorus or two here and there. Thank you. And that's about it. This is the Stan Getz Show, and it's a good show. Stan is in great voice here. The tempos are a little bit down as far as I'm concerned. I would like to see one more up-tempo number. The first number, Litha, I don't know how you say that, L-I-T-H-A, that's more up-tempo, and Stan is in his sweet spot there. And then we get a bossa, O Grande Amor, and then we get what to me is the best number on the album, Sweet Rain, which is very slow tempo. And then we get a couple of slightly faster tempo songs in Kanalma and those. And we're very much in cocktail here, but it's the kind of music that if you were making martinis and you were shaking maker where this was playing, you might stop and go, oh, wait, what's that? And you might actually, it's not just background. Getz's soloing is so limpid and so thoughtful and beautiful that it will just cause you to stop what you're doing. This happened to me numerous times when I was prepping for this. I'd have, as I've mentioned many times, I'll have all the numbers on the podcast on a playlist sort of rotating. And when Getz's stuff came on, I often found myself stopping and listening. It just has sort of moments of arresting beauty. His playing is so good. And on the slower numbers, he gets kind of breathy, which I like. And then on the more up-tempo stuff on Litha, he's less breathy. He's a little more just punching it. I like that. I like this quite a bit. I probably like it less than you do because I suspect your copy, you have to kind of wipe it off now and again. But I do like this quite a bit. So go ahead. Tell us how awesome this is. I know that's what you want to do. So do it.
I have to wipe off all my LPs. You have to keep LPs clean. I don't know what else you could possibly mean. You know, I think the main thing was I picked up a couple Getz albums, and he's never been for me a central player, somebody that I spent a lot of time with or obsessed over. Sometimes I find him a little bit off-putting. It's beautiful, but not necessarily engaging to me. And some of his projects, of course, just don't work. I mean, he recorded extensively, and so of course not every album is going to be as good as every other album. What impressed me about this after listening to it, and it took 3 or 4 listens, is my sense is this is one of my favorite, if not favorite, Getz albums. And he nominated, and I think it's a very strong candidate, Focus, the album he did with Strings. And that is an excellent record. But after right. that, and maybe as good as that, and certainly if you're looking for kind of a more traditional jazz ensemble recording, I'd say this is a place to go. And again, I was struck by the fact that I think a lot more people who have heard about Getz at all have heard of something like Captain Marvel, which I just don't think is as interesting a project or successful a project anyway. And Marvel there, again, I feel like he was trying to kind of find himself in the mostly acoustic fusion music environment that people like Chick Corea were kind of working on with the original incarnation of Return to Forever. And frankly, I probably like Joe Farrell better. You know, it struck me, I might like Joe Farrell better as a saxophone player than Stan Getz, which is a weird thing to think given the difference in their profiles and the sheer number of recordings that Getz made as a leader where Joe was not widely recorded. And I'd probably say I don't know that Joe was quite the genius that Getz was in certain ways, but just as a player, you know, just as a personality, as a sound, I might lean towards Farrell. And, of course, Joe could play baritone, alto, tenor, soprano, flute brilliantly. Getz just focused on playing tenor at an extremely high level. But what struck me about this record was it's kind of the second great quintet by Miles Davis for beginners. It's like this is where I feel like he is trying out in a gentler, kinder way some of the stuff that you might hear on an ESP or a Nefertiti. Korea is just a more melodic and accessible player, and really he's the dominating force compositionally here, whereas in the great quintet it's not Herbie Hancock, right, who also has an accessible bubbly side. It's Shorter, who's a darker, more elusive character, right? He is kind of the music director and the main composer.
Yes,
but the shifting of tempos and everything, now it's never the rhythm section taking over and bending time and playing with relativity and you know, using alchemy. It is a more controlled ebb and flow, especially that first track where the, you know, it speeds up, it slows down, but you, in a sense, in a regular way, it's not like this just came over us, let's try it out and see if Miles can keep up. It's, you know, we're going to do this in a pattern that Stan knows about because otherwise he'll yell at us and hit us with his tenor, you know, or whatever he does. But I just felt like he's right on the cusp here of, he's certainly not the player from the 50s or the bossa nova craze. He is trying something a little bit more experimental, but not quite out of his comfort zone yet. Whereas I feel like in Captain Marvel, he's a little bit out of his comfort zone. He's just not finding enough harmonic meat in what he's playing over to kind of do his best. And yeah, it's just a gorgeous sounding record. It is a, it's a pleasure from start to finish without becoming, I think, maudlin or cloying. I think it's, there's always some meat there. And I'm always surprised, just as we were when we listened to the Bossa album, you forget that Getz, at least in his later career, is a crier. He's sometimes, as you said, the most aggressive player. I mean, he's got this beautiful tone, but he's not all about the float. Instead of like Lester Young, where he's the floating balladeer and then the bumping R&B-er, it's the balladeer with the kind of tortured romantic. Getz is a little bit darker, I guess, emotionally. There's a little bit more agony in his sound, along with all the pleasure. So I just feel like this is an album, and I've heard other people say this. I'm by no means like the first guy to come forward and say this may be Getz's best album. Many people have done it. It was an album I wasn't even really aware of when I just picked it up as a used LP. And I thought, you know, after a few listens, you know, it didn't strike me right away. It's like, wait a minute, this is really damn good. And it really hangs together as a record, I think. And this is 37 minutes that really make a lot of sense. And I think Getz benefits from as much as he can. And again, Getz is never going to be in my handful of favorite players. I like him. And I tend towards his kind of music. That's one of my favorite genres, right? The mellow, the blanket fort. But he is not my favorite occupant of that fort. By any means. Anyway, just a recommendation. If you can track down a copy, I think it's good stuff.
I would also say, unlike the Basie, I would say if you've never heard Stan Getz, this is fine. You could jump in right here, like a novice and someone who's listened to the music for years. Both will find pleasure here. I mean, this is an album of lyric beauty. So newbies in jazz would enjoy this. It seems to me, if you've never heard Stan Getz before. It's okay. You can rest assured that this will not hurt. This will actually be quite rewarding.
Yeah, I ran across, it might have been at All About Jazz, somebody doing kind of an overview of Getz, and they listed 10 albums, and like 4 or 5 of them were Bossa albums. And I'd say for a jazz fan, Focus and Sweet Rain. And then, yeah, absolutely, by all means, get 1 or 2 of the Bossa Nova projects. They're excellent music. But he didn't mention Sweet Rain. He may have left Focus off. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about, dude? At least from my point of view, the 2 albums you need as a jazz fan would be Focus and this.
Right.
Sweet Rain. By all means, I love Bossa. I would say, you know, get those. And they're all kind of short and mostly they're kind of sweet. The big band one is a little bit hit or miss. But I'd say in terms of just jazz content, Focus and this are where to go. And it may well be that if you're not of my persuasion, that's enough. You may not need any more Getz or want any more Getz, but it's probably worth, I think, hearing at least that much. I mean, he is, if nothing else, he's an enormously talented player. He's not, as far as I can tell, a brilliant band leader or conceptualist, and he appears to have been a spectacularly shitty human being. But, you know, he's a player who's just so talented. You know, you got to hear him. There's that 3-second delay. Yeah. Oh, well. Okay. Well, I've said my piece. If you said yours, are we ready to move on to Miles Davis?
Let's move on. We'll be right back.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, talk a little bit about this. It's not really that recent anymore. As you said, 2001 issue of yet another Fillmore East concert, this one with a supposedly lost quintet involving Korea, Shorter, DeJohnette, and I'm sorry, it's Holland. It's Dave Holland on bass, right? And then a percussionist who apparently doesn't count.
Dave Holland.
Yeah, yes. They don't give him. Dave Holland on mainly electric bass. So you have right. to think about what the thinking there was. So have you listened? I know I've listened to probably more extensively than it's good for my health to Electric Miles. Have you listened to most of that? Where do you place this? Is there a particular reason you picked this one out?
The reason I picked it out was that it just hit my rotation again. So that's partly why I picked it out. But then as I listened to it, I realized that it does something for me that I think is useful in the Miles discography. And it's useful perhaps to think about that in comparison to what Ambrose Akamusare is doing on his double album Live Date at the Vanguard. So what's interesting about this date live at the Fillmore East, there's several things. This isn't, of course, Miles' first go-round with electric, but it's an early live date showing what they could do with this music live. So that's interesting. In some ways, you can think of it as kind of consolidating the Bitches Brew sessions, which were famously sprawling and sort of they just kind of let the tape run and edited themselves an album, which would lead you to think that perhaps those songs or that band live would be a mess, but they're not. So this is that band live. It's a double CD set, but in some ways it's pretty brisk. They were opening for Neil Young, and that album also, that's a live album as well, that Neil Young at the More East this same night, I believe, was also recorded. So that's kind of fun to think about, that the kids came to see Neil Young and they got Electric Miles. So the songs here, there's no transition between them, which I happen to like. I like how we just go from one to the next. Occasionally, you'll hear the kids try to clap, and we're already 30 seconds into the next song. Korea, once again, stands out for his ability to duel, to play with other people, even in a larger setting, a quintet or a sextet. He finds a way to kind of be the voice that people dialogue with. And he serves that function through both CDs here. It's a short set list. There's really only there's four songs on the first CD and I think six on the second. But there's some repeats. We get Zawinu's directions to open both CDs, for example. We get Spanish Key both times. We get It's About That Time both times. And so there's a couple of things here that recommend this, I think, that are worth people listening for. First of all, this is Miles in the electric period playing like a motherfucker. He is on fire on this date. He is in great voice. He's blowing fast. He's blowing a lot. And whatever the distortion is, they must have had this sort of set up so that it's all going through. There's some kind of distortion here, right? So there's fuzz on everybody here. Nevertheless, in spite of all the fuzz, this is as engaged and energetic and fiery as Miles was live for a long time. Those who think of the early years of Fusion when Miles was playing this stuff and him just sort of noodling while chaos went on around him. This double CD puts the lie to that. He's in amazing form here, and he's playing with fire and passion with or without the mute. Even when he has the mute in, he is blowing. And in particular, he seems energized. The Penguins point this out, but they're right. He seems energized by the presence of Korea. He and Korea are like trading notes and fours all the time. All of these songs have the same format. They all start out the same way. They may start out with some percussion. They may start out with Miles kind of blowing at first, but eventually they settle into their groove and it turns into the Miles and Chick Corea show. And Miles solos and the openings of these songs go on for 2-3 minutes, and it's him and Corea duking it out. And then he drops out and Wayne Shorter plays. And Wayne's got a fire lit under his ass too. He's playing with a lot more energy and a lot more fury than one is accustomed to hearing him play with. He plays both tenor and soprano here. And I don't know about you, but I thought when he played soprano, he sounded uncannily like Miles sometimes, just in some of his phrases and some of his choices. But he too seems to be inspired by the pairing with Korea, and he will then kind of duel and cross swords with Korea for a couple of minutes. And then typically both horns lay out and Korea will play. He'll solo a bit on his own here. If you don't have the big boy headphones, you're not going to hear what Dave Holland is doing here. Dave Holland and Jack DeJohnette are working overtime. They are awesome on this date. They are fantastic. None of this stuff going on in the other voices would work if the two of them didn't have that boiler room stoked and just going throughout the whole date. They are incredible here. And where Tony Williams kind of lives and dies on the cymbals, Jack DeJohnette kind of lives and dies on the whole kit. He's all over the place. He's not a kind of cymbal-driven player the way Williams in the early days of the second quintet was. DeJohnette is super busy, but not overwhelming the proceedings. And I actually find the percussion here by Erto Moreira pretty good. There are times where he kind of gooses things along. He's not a featured voice, but he is useful here. And oftentimes I feel like the percussion is negligible, but there are places where what he's doing kind of pushes matters along. So I like this date a lot. I think this is Miles in some of his best, most impassioned playing. Shorter is in great form here, and it just improves, in my own mind, the status of Chick Corea as an ensemble player, which is, through a lot of things I've been listening to recently, my estimation of Chick Corea has been steadily rising. And hearing him on this and also on that Getz date, just, and they couldn't be in some ways more different, but in other ways more alike. I mean, his role in both cases is able support, but engaged counterpunching, engaged playing off of the lead voices to kind of add tension and excitement to this music. And as I said, there's no announcements, there's no naming of cuts. It's just four or six songs in a row right after one another. And there's like no time to take a breath. You guys are just working. I guess Miles is resting when Wayne Shorter and Korea are soloing. But otherwise, this is just tight. I like this a lot. I think this is a great find. I'm really glad that Columbia did bring it out. And for people who tend to shit on Miles' playing during the Fusion period, they need to listen to this, because this is Miles live and it's very much working without a net, and it's very, very good. Very playing of a very high caliber on everyone's part here, it seems to me. What did you think?
Yeah, I liked it, and I think I've had it for a while, but this encouraged me to kind of focus in on it. I think I got past the barrier for me with this, which is the distortion, especially on the electric piano. And I don't think anything on God's green planet sounds worse than an overdriven, distorted electric piano. It just makes bagpipes seem soothing. There's just something terrible about that sound. And I thank God that Miles never enlisted bagpipe players. And I think, again, the first piece... yeah, can you imagine? The first piece on that first disc is among the most aggressive, interface, and distorted. And I think after that, the music gets more interesting. It doesn't get any more intense, but you do get the sense of Korea talking with Miles and talking with Shorter. And there is one advantage is this is kind of the core of the Bitches Brew band, but it's half the musicians. You know, he had three keyboards going. I think it was Larry Young and Chick, yeah. or Herbie Hancock. He had guitar in there with McLaughlin, yeah. You know, and of course Benny Maupin on bass clarinet, pricelessly appearing on that date. So here, as you strip down this music and have just a few musicians playing it, it's a little easier to make sense of what's going on, and it's a little bit more like traditional jazz than the really texture-oriented and multiple lines at once-oriented music in Bitches Brew, which I've grown to love a lot. And that, boy, that music really depended for me on getting a clean, clear, remastered digital copy where I could kind of start making sense of the various strands going on at once. Because if you're looking for a master line or a melody in that music, you'll never be happy. And I was for many years and was never happy with it. You've got to really be in the flow. You know, Miles is very strong here. I do hear him playing certain licks that become crutches in this period, and to some degree appeared in the Great Quintet, the second Great Quintet period, where he's kind of doing crab-wise motions, you know, a little step-wise motions chromatically across the line that you feel like that's a lick he could play over anything. And it would work, but it wouldn't be all that telling. And he does that as a kind of a space filler. I mean, I think his greatest soloing in terms of just building a statement was earlier, but he does fantastically nonetheless in this environment, and I think he is physically in great shape. And we got to remember, this is 70 March, so it's early in the Electric period that just kind of becomes this sequence of double albums. And, of course, by 74, 75, he is nearing his exit from the scene for several years. He is physically getting rougher and rougher. So, yeah, this is him when he's still strong playing in this idiom. And, of course, the crucial thing, difference here to the later Electric period stuff is no guitar, right? A lot of those later recordings, like Dark Magus, he's got a two or three guitar front line. And the saxophone becomes a lot more vestigial. There's always a sax player there, but rarely one who's so important. Where here, obviously, he's a much smaller ensemble, and it does not have the guitar. I kind of wonder if the sounds that Korea is coaxing from the electric piano are an attempt almost to substitute for a Jimi Hendrix-sounding guitar. I assume that was part of the idea, was to make it a kind of distorted counterpart to electric guitar.
The absence of guitar here is absolutely crucial. I've never been a fan of John McLaughlin's playing with Miles, and I always thought it muddied and complicated the waters. I always preferred Benson. And the absence of guitar here, it, to me, makes all the difference. This is recognizably the music of the second quintet transformed by electricity. You can recognize the essential kind of format. It's not that different in some ways, right? And the format even goes back to bebop. It's two horns over rhythm section soloing, and everyone kind of takes their turn, you know, and it's almost formulaic. Miles, then Wayne, then Chick. And without the extra bells and whistles, you really can kind of parse what's going on, like you said.
And Dave Holland here is playing a more activist and interesting bass role, whereas very soon the bass player becomes this teenager, Michael Henderson, I believe is the name, who I think came from maybe Stevie Wonder's camp, or in any case, he brought a very simplified rhythm and blues bass approach that became the foundation of this really dense, simmering electric jungle music that Miles started doing with the two and the three guitars, or in the On the Corner period. Yeah, this is still, I think, more recognizably jazz in a sense. And then he moves on to something else. And I like Dark Magus. I like On the Corner. it's a different kind of music, but this is a bridge to it that I think makes more sense to people who are used to earlier Miles or more mainstream jazz. So, yeah, I think this is, it's a valuable document. I think it's good.
I caught you knocking at my cellar door. I love you, baby, can I have some more?
One more thing I want to mention or talk about here is how strange it is that this album is recorded on the same night that they recorded Neil Young's Live at the Fillmore East. And just wrap your head around that. You know, Neil Young on that date, he did two sets. One is an acoustic set and then another is an electric set with his backing band Crazy Horse. And this made me try and think of other amazing moments in the history of jazz where jazz and rock, such as it is, appeared on the same stage. You know, I mean, this was a weird time where that could actually happen. What was Neil Young thinking when he booked Miles to open for him? What was Sun Ra thinking when he booked MC5 to open for him, this proto-punk band? What were the different constituents of the audience thinking when they came to these dates with the Neil Young long hairs, maybe smoking weed? I don't know what Miles's followers look like at this point, right? And it's scary to think about what MC5's fans look like compared to the Sun Ra, Take Us to Planet Egypt followers were like, you know, back in Detroit in the day. So when I thought about this, it made me wonder about other pairings, and maybe our listeners, if they know of interesting moments where jazz bands opened or played for unlikely rock bands or vice versa, they could send us their lists of their most interesting pairings. Because did Miles and Neil hang out backstage and chat? What would that have been like? Was that, you know, did Miles introduce Neil to cocaine? You know, Neil's like, hey, smoke a doobie. And Miles is like, I'm way past that, man. You know, when would those conversations, would there be conversations? What would they be like? You know, I'd like to be a fly on the wall when Neil Young and Miles Davis started chatting. That would be fascinating. And of course, it would be fascinating to be a fly on the wall for any conversation with Sun Ra and another human being, not
or a
in his
human
band.
Being. We're not so, sure. Yeah.
Or just a human, just a non-alien, you know? So yeah, I'd like to know what you, is that something you even think about? Is that kind of surprising to you or no? Think about Neil at this date.
Well, and apparently people, I've read mention as well of the Steve Miller Band, and I know that Miles felt a great contempt for that outfit, maybe from this experience and their level of musicianship or lack thereof, right? Fly like an eagle on this, motherfucker. And I really don't know where the Steve Miller Band, even if they had hits of this, I just don't know their history that well. And a couple of their FM staples are fine with me. I don't have, you know, but I did try to listen to one of their albums all the way through and realize they're a singles band in a very vivid way. Yeah, I guess it's kind of the FM radio freeform moment in cultural history, right? In the late 60s, early 70s, where people were playing sides of LPs and the programming had radically opened up for a brief moment, and they would mix things like jazz and rock and black music and just kind of play different genres without worrying about siloing them off. And that moment passed, obviously, and the formats got more and more locked down. I mean, the closest modern parallel, I guess, would be something like Kamasi Washington and Kendrick Lamar, right? That collective seemed to be all working on each other's projects, and they kind of run a spectrum from, you know, whatever you want to say about Kamasi, it's more or less hardcore jazz. I don't think it's great jazz, but it's, you know, it's clearly of that genre and kind, all the way over to serious rap. And kind of waypoints in between, and whatever the hell drunk was, right? Which is kind of hard to categorize. So in a sense, maybe that's coming back a little bit in the California scene right now. But yeah, I would have loved to know whether both Neil Young and Miles Davis were making fun of Steve Miller, or, you know, what they were doing around back. It's hard to say. There are some reviews will comment on, you know, the very end of it, a couple stoners are like, yeah, encore, dude. It's like, you know, Miles doesn't do encores. No, that's not going to happen. but just kind of bewildered. The sense that, that the commentators get is that the audience had no idea what the fuck was happening here. And can you blame them? I think, you know, as somebody who's listened to dozens of hours of Miles Davis for 40 years, this is still kind of a hard thing to process. So you can imagine somebody who was ready to hear Heart of Gold trying to make sense of, or I'm not sure if that song was out yet or not. I'm not a youngologist, but, you know, roughly speaking, folky Neil Young, I don't know. They probably had their minds blown. I was going to read a couple quotations to you that I found about this album and Ambrose's album. See if you can match them. Okay, so two quotes that I found online from various reviews. The first one, it's almost too good to listen to. A couple of seconds of this contains enough musical information to frazzle your synapses forever. The second one is, I look forward to hearing more from them. Can you match the quote to the recording?
Oh, dear. Well, I'm going to hope that the first one was Miles and the second one was Ambrose. But I'm going to be afraid that, in fact, the first was Ambrose and the second was Miles.
Which would be kind of ironic. I look forward to hearing more from that. Good luck with that. No, you're absolutely right. We're now going to go to our last selection, Ambrose Akinmusires. I believe, you know, he says his name twice, but he mumbles it, and that's distinctive. His
Akinmusires. I've always had this. I've had this name right from the beginning. I've always pronounced it right from the beginning. I was happy to have that confirmed by hearing him say his own name. So,
ironically,
props
right
to
now
me.
I'm wearing a T-shirt anyway, that says Mike is always right. Yeah, it just happened to be that day. Yeah, a rift in decorum, live at the Village Vanguard, and I actually called Blue Note up and asked them, well, how did he pick a rift in decorum? And they said, well, there were several titles they tried. One was going to be a play on Miles Davis's Live Evil album called Live Private. They'd also considered calling the album Serenade to a Spit Valve. And Donkey Hoity Toity. And guys, you can unparse that pun at your leisure later. So this is a weird record. It's a lot of Ambrose's quartet, a couple hours worth. And the titles are all amazing in his style. And it's a live album, though I think it's very well recorded, aside from the bass, which to me seems kind of boomy and indistinct, especially on the first set. So thoughts about this? We have done Ambrose's music before. I think our very first episode featured some of that. Is that right?
That is correct. Ambrose is one of our special select. We have now done three. He's up there with Gregory Porter and Brad Meldow and God knows who else. People who we've come back to three times. But in his case, third time, he's only done, three major releases? Is that right? So we've
around
kind
there.
Of been with him from the beginning,
yeah,
as it were.
We did episode one, and then episode 53 we did his release The Imagined Savior is Easier to Paint. And now, of course, we're doing his live album. I feel like that's his... probably at least his three major releases. There may be something else in there, but I think those are kind of the big ones on Blue Note. So how did you feel about this one as compared to the two studio efforts?
So what I was hoping was that this would crystallize, because I have found in our previous two podcasts where we talked about The Imagined Savior and When the Heart Emerges Glistening, I have found him difficult to come to terms with. not that he's not a really good player. He is a good player. But I think, and I didn't listen to those podcasts again because I can't stand to hear my voice. But as I recall, on both occasions, I liked him and wanted to see where he was going. But also, I find him hard to – I haven't clicked with him yet. And I was hoping that with this live date, it would function in some ways the way that Live at Fillmore East might for some people in Miles Electric period, that this would be a kind of live statement that would, you know, I'd finally go, ah, that's what's going on with Ambrose. Oh, I get this, or I understand this. And I'm still in the same place, maybe getting a little closer to finally grokking with this music. So he's of, you know, normally he works in a quintet, and normally Walter Smith III, whom we have also done a podcast about, Walter Smith III is his running buddy, and Walter Smith isn't here. So that puts a lot of pressure on Ambrose, because this is a quartet setting and he's the lead voice here. And here's what I'll say about this. When this is good, I think it's very good. And when it's bad, or let's say when it's less good, it's boring. So the cuts that for me, I'll give you an example of a cut that I find boring, or just I have a hard time getting impassioned about, right? That would be the sketches in general don't hold my attention. But the trumpet sketch with Milky Pete, called Trumpet Sketch Milky Pete, that's 14 minutes long. Initially, it sounds like a kind of horn in search of a theme. I don't know. I have a hard time. That one gives me trouble. I don't particularly like it. But then on other songs where he's more lyrical, I think it's A Moment in Between the Rest. I liked that. Or maybe it's Brooklyn. It's one of these sort of more moody, melodic pieces where I think you get a sense of him as a player with someone who can play pretty. It's not that he doesn't play pretty in other albums, but there were moments here that I felt like, well, I like that. That's beautiful. I wanted to hear more of that, I guess. But then there are just other times where I'm still sort of just struggling to figure out his world or to connect to his sound world. Trumpet in a quartet setting is tough because that's going to be your main lyrical voice, unless, you know, they're going to engage in something like sustained piano duels. And that doesn't seem to be the case very often here. So this is often sparse. I'm just still having trouble connecting with him. But on the evidence of this outing, I want to keep trying, I guess, because there are more moments of, and maybe I'm just forgetting the songs, because I'm looking at the way I've got it formatted here on my computer. I'm looking at the titles like alphabetically, so I can't remember which ones were the more lyrical numbers that I kind of connected to. But those were the ones that I liked better. I don't know how you feel about this. I suspect he still isn't connecting for you either. Are you closer to connecting with his stuff, or still kind of out there on this?
I think in some ways this is his most distinctive record. I think that the other dates sounded like state-of-the-art grad school jazz, but didn't always have as clear a fingerprint. Certain obsessions emerge here. One is kind of these, I don't know, they're not quite, I mean, this edges at times. I will say this, as a Blue Note release, it actually gets close to the avant-garde sometimes. And the piano playing is sometimes a little
bit. That is surprising, yeah. Yeah.
my whole Serenade to a Spit Valve and whatever donkey references, he's making some odd noises on his horn.
Yes.
Quite often. I don't find them emotionally or musically all that effective or affecting. They're there. But I feel like the second set is just much stronger. The first set I find rough sledding. It's just kind of, it does get dull in stretches, and he seems kind of obsessed with sound effects at times. There's not much of a lyrical flow going. Apparently these were recently composed tunes. They're all originals. Not sure that's a great idea. This has got to be the most introspective, inward-looking live album I've ever heard. He's certainly not pandering to anybody. There's no sense he's trying to entertain people.
Yes. Nope.
The second set, it does get a little bit more traditionally melodic. I like that better. That last tune where it's literally just one note over and over again. I mean, it's daring. It's a little annoying, but it's memorable. I don't know that he strikes me as somebody with a great compositional gift, and I think that's the problem with so many jazz players, is that they stack albums with originals, and they just aren't very good at writing songs. And I understand from a financial point of view why you might want to do that, so you have some kind of royalty for when you get plays, and God knows it's a hard life to lead, but wow, I don't know that I'm impressed with him as a composer from this, not that they were awful, but were any of them that memorable? I don't think so. So yeah, I'm probably where you are.
Yeah, I mean, I remember moments rather than songs. Right? There are moments here. I was struck with the places where it seemed like he was reaching for something, where he was expressing a feeling, where he was being more lyrical. Some of this felt like exercises to me. The ones that are called sketches sometimes feel like you're trying to like they're warm ups for something else. You know, I take your point about the composition thing, and I sometimes wonder if it might not be better to intersperse with your own compositions the songs that inspired you to make those compositions and your take on those songs, right? So if something by Art Farmer trips your trigger, then take it out. Take it way out. I mean, I take it Ambrose would take anything by Art Farmer pretty far out. Take that song and take it for a deep spin, and then put the song that it inspired you to write next to it. Maybe that seems sacrilegious on the part of some of these young players, you know, to put your stuff next to the greats who inspired you. But it would give more context and give more of a sense of where some of the stuff is coming from. I guess what I'm saying is I'm getting closer with Ambrose and certainly not giving up on him. I do want to keep trying with this music, but it's hard. It's tough sledding, like you said. Sometimes you kind of have to force yourself to like try and figure out what's going on here and why he's doing what he's doing. Like you said, with the one note solo and the final cut, holy cats, that's tough. Yeah, it's frustrating. I'm frustrated maybe more with myself now with this music, because I feel like there is something here and I'm not quite getting it. Maybe, I don't know. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, that's absolutely okay. This is a question. Is the barrier our lack of understanding, or is it that as a very young man, he's just kind of over freighting what he's up to, is a little too pretentious about it, hence the titles, and a little too worried about not playing a lick that someone else has played before? Some of the playing on, especially the first set, just strikes me as someone whose one goal is avoiding playing a line that some other trumpet player has played in the jazz continuum. And I get that, but unless you come up with something more interesting than what he did come up with, I'd rather learn to live with it, that you're going to have a mix of materials from your predecessors with new stuff or new takes on it, new twists. Some of it ultimately comes down to personality, taste. People are playing licks that are not harmonically all that inventive or whatever, but do they string them together in a way that makes emotional sense? Do they know how to articulate and deliver them in a way that touches you, that seems honest, or do they fail at that? And by the way, I strongly recommend The Summer Knows by Art Farmer. That's not just blanket fort music. That is having sex in the blanket fort music. So look that one up. That is, my God, that is just so naughty. I love that fucking record. But the reason it works for me and doesn't just make me go into a sugar coma is that Art Farmer is really, really good at what he does. And he makes really good choices. And it's probably on the beyond the edge of schmaltz for some people, but my feeling with it is that he earns the schmaltz that he does indulge in, and there's a lot of playing with spine, and it's so pleasurable. But it's way at the very far end of that. Ambrose is like way in the desert of extreme seriousness, extreme worry about cliche to a degree that I think is straitjacketing him. I mean, I just want him to relax a bit, and you feel like that's what would happen in a live setting. I've often said, to the point where frequent listeners are sick to death of it, listen to Greg Osby's live stuff. That's where the man loosens up a bit. That stuff is awesome. This is not the case here. I mean, this is more studio than studio. He reminds me a little bit of a John Hassell, this guy that mainly just plays breath sounds with the trumpet. I don't know. I'm looking for a context where he expresses himself in a more emotionally direct way for me. And I don't care if it's atonal. I don't care if it's strangely rhythmic or obsessive. I just want a feeling of more direct him to me rather than him processing what it is he's trying to do in a very intellectualized way and then making a product that fits those requirements to me. And I don't know. Maybe I'm romanticizing the way jazz works. I don't know. But right now I feel like there's a barrier still. That said, I liked parts of this album. I think the piano player got a lot of space and was doing at least some adventuresome stuff. They certainly gave him a lot of room to solo on, and at times he would kind of take it outside. So again, it's probably an important album to listen to if you're a jazz fan in 2017 and want to know what kind of the cutting edge is, but I don't think he's there yet for me anyway. Anything else on Ambrose?
No, I just think he's worth sticking with, but I'm not there, or he's not there, or we're not there together yet. But I do find him interesting. I do find his music interesting. I sometimes feel like I'm not over the hump with him. I like this better than that last release, The Imagined Savior, because there were some vocals on that album that really got up my nose, that really irritated me. And this is free of that. And it's free of any sort of posturing toward, it's almost ascetic in its purity of jazz, right? There's no pandering here or attempt to connect to anything overtly political or newsworthy in a way to kind of gin up interest, right? This isn't Wadada Leo Smith, right? This is just abstract, and you're going to listen to it and you're going to like it, damn it. So there's a kind of rigor and asceticism here that I respect and that makes me want to try harder. But like you said, it's not like he's reaching out to please you, or he's reaching out to express an emotion. At least if he is, I'm not feeling it yet, except on some of those more lyrical moments where I'm like, ah, God, he can play pretty. Yeah, I'm not quite there yet. But I want to keep trying. Keep going, Ambrose. I'll keep buying. I'll keep listening.
Well, it's like you say.
All right, that's all I have to say about Ambrose.
There are dogs in jazz, there are cats in jazz, and there are autistic cats in jazz. And I think right now Ambrose is still an autistic cat. He's not just ignoring you. He can't quite communicate at all. Well, we'll see. I think that we need to see a counselor together, the three of us, and we can work out our relationship difficulties and maybe find something richer and better with him. I don't know if he's available or not. We'll see what we can schedule in. Do you have any pop matters to talk about this time?
I think one or two. My most recent listen is this thing I just got on my never-ending quest to figure out what it is about hip-hop or rap that I might actually like, by this guy named Logic. He has a long, incredibly pretentious name, which I think is his real name, but it's long and pretentious. Like, his first name is Sir Robert, and then there's like five more names. but he's a rapper who goes by the handle of Logic. And the disc, which I'm still working through, is called The Incredible True Story. And it's another one of these attempts to do Afrofuturism. So the premise of the album is the main character is an astronaut, a space traveler from a future Earth, and he and his buddy are traveling, and they also have like a mixtape from a rapper named Logic from the early 21st century that they play and then comment on, and the tracks are both futuristic. It's sort of like someone was smoking too much weed and listened to Ziggy Stardust and decided to make a rap album. But some of it is quite pretty. Some of it is quite lyrical. Usually hip hop is about, you know, rap is about, you know, the beats and, you know, the thudding bass. And this has moments of prettiness to it on my first listen. And I want to go through it again and try and attend a little more closely to the chat parts in between. Afrofuturism, as you probably know, it's like Sun Ra had a grandchild and its name is Afrofuturism. This idea that, well, Janelle Monáe's Arc Android is a good example. Okay. This also would be an example. This sort of idea of linking, you know, futuristic sci-fi concerns to an Afrocentric musicality. And so this is sort of in that genre. And I do find it interesting. It may just be crap because I've only listened to it once and some of it stood out and some of it was filler, but I want to give it another go. It has the worst cover of any hip hop album I think I've ever seen. It has Logic in a spacesuit at the helm of a spaceship, and he's piloting it straight toward you, but he's not looking at you. He's looking slightly over your head, and his four crew members, bandmates, are sitting around him staring in awe at the thing toward which he is piloting his ship. It's really fucking weird, the cover. It's sort of cartoon. It's not like a picture. It's like a cartoon version of this. I don't know. But I find this interesting. I don't know if that's a good thing to say. I find it interesting. The other hip hop I've listened to recently, I don't find interesting and find largely forgettable. But this one I kind of like. So we'll see if it gets more play and if I get deeper into it and I like him better. But it's just the concept of it I think is kind of interesting. The other hip hop I've heard, you know, I don't want to insult people who love this stuff, but I've listened to some stuff by Jeezy and Future, and I've been overly impressed. Also, I listened to perhaps the best titled hip hop CD ever by a rapper named Earl Sweatshirt, which is the fucking best name. Earl Sweatshirt, and his album is called I Don't Like Shit, I Don't Go Outside.
Sounds like he's Japanese.
A hip hop album for Pat. I Don't Like Shit, I Don't Go Outside. It's very down tempo, and parts of it are funny, but it's marred by some of the same misogyny and other bullshit that a lot of these albums are marred by. So I get tired of that very quickly. Yeah, so I don't know. If you ever get a chance, don't buy it. Listen to it and then decide. The Incredible True Story by Logic. It actually has a much longer, much more pretentious title, but most people know it as The Incredible True Story. I think it goes on and on, like, of a space astronaut, blah, 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 blah. So okay. That's what I've been listening to that I kind of liked today.
Cool.
New stuff. And that's, you know, I've listened to plenty of old stuff, but that's the new thing I've listened to. How about you?
Well, I'm kind of cut off, which is a good thing, from getting new music. So I've been going back through some of the music gifted to me over the years and ran across the House Martins album, London Zero Hull 4, and never really listened to House Martins before. They are very much a post-Smiths band. The singer is a pure, I don't know, tenor, soprano? What do you want to say than Morrissey? Very politicized lyrics, and it's very much the Smiths circa Meat is Murder. Not the title track, but some of the more rockabilly sounding tracks from that album are very much the very basic fabric of this band sound. Apparently they put out two records and then broke off, and I think it was the singer formed The Beautiful South, a band I'm still trying to make sense of, and then another guy became like a producer or something. So it was a short-lived band, and at the time roundly criticized for kind of aping the Smiths. Probably with some justification, but it's pleasant, melodic, sort of late 80s indie pop. And I never listened to it before. I have now. I don't know how often I'll listen to it again, but it's fun enough. That's been about it. And that concludes episode 123 of the Jazz Bastard Podcast. As always, you can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com and at mike@jazzbastard.com or through our Facebook page. You can download the podcast from www.jazzbastard.com or from iTunes. As always, we appreciate your input, suggestions, and ideas for further episodes, so please stay in touch. Tune in next time as we discuss two left-field guitar masters, Sonny Sharrock and Mary Halverson. Until next time, take care.